Good morning, everyone. First matter is Auberg and Edwards versus Jones. And Mr. Sullivan is with us remotely, I believe.
Yes, Your Honor.
You may proceed.
Good morning.
How are you feeling? I know you tested positive. How are you feeling?
I feel like I have a cold.
Okay. All right. Okay, you can go ahead.
I do want to reserve a minute and a half for rebuttal.
Okay.
May it please the court, my name is Robert Chaplin, and I represent the appellants, Ayanna Auberg and Timothy Edwards. In this case, Ms. Edwards and Mr. Auberg contend that their constitutional rights under the 4th and 14th Amendments were violated in three ways. First, Ms. Auberg's rights were violated when the police impounded her car and gave it to a company that claimed to be her creditor. Second, Ms. Auberg's rights were violated when she was falsely arrested for stealing her own car. And third, Mr. Edwards' rights were violated when he was falsely arrested for operating Ms. Auberg's vehicle, which he was actually doing with Ms. Auberg's consent.
Well, let me stop you there. Was there probable cause to justify that particular arrest?
No. There was not probable cause because...
Are you talking about Edwards or Auberg? Whose arrest?
Edwards.
Edwards. And why wasn't there probable cause vis-a-vis Edwards? He's pulled over on a legitimate traffic stop because of the blockage of the rear window, so traffic violation. So the stop is legitimate. The tags are run on NCIC. It comes up as stolen. So why isn't that enough to justify the officer for arresting him for driving a stolen car?
It's not enough because the claim is against Trooper Jones for the false arrest. Mr. Edwards' claim is against Trooper Jones for the false arrest. If Trooper Jones had...
But wait, didn't Kearney arrest Edwards?
Yes, but he did it because of Trooper Jones' false arrest report. And that arrest, after Trooper Jones makes a false arrest report, after any police officer...
Yeah, we'll break that down because Falberg, I guess it was, or Falco, had information... Was Jones relied upon? Who prepared the affidavit? Was that was Jones based upon information from Falco? Is that correct?
That's for when charges were pressed against Edwards later after his arrest. Though the arrest, we're not claiming that Officer Kearney was liable for the false arrest. We are claiming that Trooper Jones was liable for the false arrest because he shouldn't have issued a false arrest report for a vehicle. For Ms. Auberg's vehicle
because of the omissions. I get that. But you've got to break it down because information was made available to Falcon. I'm sorry. Falcon was told who the true owner of the car was. And somehow, I understand that what happened in the interim, but somehow, after the information was given by the assistant ADA that in Pennsylvania, ownership is governed by title and not lien, somehow, the determination was made that irrespective of that, there's a stolen car because AEL was the owner of the car. Now, help me there. Who made that determination? That was Falcon. Is that right?
Falcon made that determination when he did his investigation after receiving my letter in the beginning of September. Though initially it was Officer Jones who made that or Elijah Jones, who made that determination on the spot at the repossession lot where he issues the stolen vehicle report.
Okay, that's a different issue. In terms of Jones, all he knows is that a car has been driven off the lot without permission of the person who had repossessed it. He does check with AEL, and he's shown, I guess, by the guy at the lot, he's shown a piece of paper which says that AEL has the right to repossess. And then he's told that irrespective of that, the, quote, owner of the car comes and drives the car away after it had been legally impounded. You would agree that it has been legally impounded.
There was nothing illegal. Well, it wasn't impounded. It was repossessed. There was nothing illegal about the repossession, but it was done without due process. Therefore, the police cannot get involved. The police can't take the side of the creditor and say that the vehicle is stolen when there's no due process because...
Well, you know, we got to be careful because there's so many things here that can arise from this. let's keep it narrow, because now you're adding in due process and state, and that involves.
And I want you to separate out your 1983 federal claims from your state claims.
Yes.
This is getting very messy.
Well, I'm going to concentrate on the 1983 claim. Okay. That's the thrust of the case. Elijah Jones issues the stolen vehicle report, and it's impossible for the vehicle to be stolen under Pennsylvania law because a creditor, a lien holder, is not considered a victim of a theft crime.
Yeah, but if you focus in on what Jones did and then look at the test of qualified immunity, all he knows is that the car was properly repossessed. Someone then came, the owner of the car, the owner in quotation marks, came and without permission of AEL, the lien holder, who had the right to possession of the car at that time, not the title holder, she comes and drives the car away. Why wouldn't Jones, in terms of the qualified immunity threshold, why wouldn't that be reasonable, maybe wrong, but nevertheless reasonable for purposes of qualified immunity?
A reasonable police officer in Trooper Jones' position should know, based on this, for instance, this court's decision in Abbott versus Leachaw, that the police are not supposed to get involved and take sides in a self-help repossession. In Abbott versus Leachaw, this court imposed liability on that Constable Beale when he told Mr. Abbott that he would arrest him if he drove away with the van that Ms. Latshaw was trying to repossess from
him. But don't those cases speak to police officers' involvement in the actual repossession and not what happens, you know, weeks later?
Until there's due process, it's the same. I mean, all it is a creditor saying, you can't take the car because you owe us money. The creditor could not call up the police in the first instance and say, there's a guy riding around in a car who owes us money and ask the police to arrest him. Trooper Jones and all the police should understand that when a creditor asks them to repossess a car, it says that someone's not driving a car with their permission because they owe money on it, that they can't get involved with that unless, you know, as in a court order.
This is getting really messy. You say involved. Are you saying that the Jones should have just walked away and not done anything once he knew that the car was taken off the lot improperly?
It wasn't taken off the lot improperly. She drove it through an open gate that violated no law. What the established law is, for instance, in Hensley versus Gasson by the Sixth Circuit, that people have a right to resist a repossession. They don't have to acquiesce to it.
It had only been repossessed, though. The car was repossessed. The possession of the car was in AEL possessed the car at that time. So she interfered with the AEL's possessory interest in the car and drove it away. And we get into all kinds of arguments about ownership and title. And as my property professor used to say, ownership doesn't mean a great deal. You got to look at the relationship between the person who says they own it and what they say they own, and focus in on the relationship. He or she may have, quote, owned the car, but her relationship to the car was that she was in default on the loan and had lost her possessory interest in the car.
No, that's not true at all.
She didn't possess the car, did she? She didn't possess it.
It's an error to say that she was in default of the loan without due process. That's the thing.
But that doesn't mean anything to me. What do you mean by due process?
The notice and opportunity to be heard, a court hearing determining that she's in default of the
loan. Okay, but under Goldstein, didn't they have a right to, they had a right to repossess the car? You're talking about a pre-deprivation hearing.
Well, we don't know whether they had a right to repossess the car. The law allows them to do a self-help repossession even if they have no right to repossess the car. Because it's by self-help. They can just unilaterally declare a default. They could do it purposely. They could do it by mistake. They can take a car, and they've repossessed it, but that doesn't mean that there's a default. There's not a default that the police can act on until there's some due process.
The term due process is not really
Until there's notice and opportunity to be heard.
Okay. All right. Okay.
This court said that the police cannot hold a curbside courtroom to determine who has a superior possessory interest in a car. A court has to determine that. So when she drives off with the car without any breach of the peace, then she's in possession of the car, and she's only in the possession of the car because the repo lots never have had the gate open. If they repossess a car, they're supposed to protect the collateral. And really, a reasonable police officer in Mr. Jones' position, when he hears that Ms. Ahlberg drove the car through an open gate, should have asked, well, why was the gate open?
So you're saying, what did the 1983 violation then occurred when he entered the information into NCIC? Is that the point? Or is that the act that triggers liability under 1983?
That's the first thing. It certainly does, because that leads to that entry of the false arrest, entry of the theft report, which was a false theft report, and a theft report he should have known was false.
Well, what is the tag on that deprivation of liability? When he enters it into NCIC, that's not a false arrest, right? He hasn't interfered with her coming and going, so she's not arrested there. So what is that? What is the nature of the animal?
Well, that is the violation, but it's led in course for that foreseeable results. There are foreseeable results from entering in.
But what is the 1983? What do you call it? It's not false arrest. What is it?
It is false arrest.
She's not arrested. She's driving down. She's not arrested when the information goes into NCIC. She's not in custody.
As a foreseeable result of entering into the false arrest report into the NCIC, then Mr. Edward gets arrested.
Let me stop you there on Edwards again. Edwards ultimately pled guilty to a summary offense, right?
Yes.
So how does that impact your claim with respect to Edwards?
He would never have been arrested if there wasn't for the false arrest.
For malicious.
He stopped the car because he read that it was stolen.
But it was not a favorable disposition.
Go ahead. I'm sorry. For malicious prosecution, you have to show it ended without a conviction. He was convicted. End of story.
Well, what I read and cited in my brief was that there's a rebuttable presumption that a conviction, in this case, the pleading guilty to the to driving without a license, indicates probable cause. But the probable cause was the false report that the car was stolen, which should never have been entered into.
Based on the facts, Officer Kearney knew he had probable cause.
But we're not bringing the false arrest claim. Mr. Edwards' false arrest claim for the actual initial arrest is not against Officer Kearney. It's against Trooper Jones.
Except Kearney's the one who made the arrest. Judge McKee and I are having the same problem. False arrest is against the person who arrests you. This is something different then.
The person who caused the arrest was Trooper Jones by making the false arrest report. That has a foreseeable result, the proximate cause.
Do you have any precedent in which person A scheming back at police headquarters cackles and causes person B to make an arrest and person A gets hit with false arrest liability?
Person A, yes, because there are cases.
Do you have precedent?
Cited. I believe it's cited in my brief. I might be in a footnote because it's a probable. It comes up under proximate cause. That it's a proximate cause issue that a police officer would do something like enter a false arrest claim. And then
you're not suggesting there was a conspiracy between the officers, are you? You didn't plead it, right?
No.
All right.
But there's a foreseeable result from entering a stolen vehicle report that someone down the line will be arrested or will be stopped and arrested for driving that stolen vehicle. Now, after Mr. Edwards' arrest, then they write a affidavit of probable cause that misrepresents the ownership of the vehicle. And, you know, with Ms. Auberg, she's not arrested.
See, that troubles me, but I don't know what to do with it. I just don't know what to do with that. And I'm not getting a great deal of assistance in our discussion here, because clearly information was relayed, I think, September 6th, from the assistant DA to, I think it was Falcone. Under Pennsylvania law, ownership of a vehicle is governed by title and not lien. Nevertheless, based upon the lien holder, AL being the lien, someone else, and the names I'm getting confused here, takes out an affidavit of probable cause saying that AEL is the owner. But I don't know what to do with it. It's clearly wrong. I have no idea what to do with it.
It's a violation for that cause. Well, for Ms. Auberg, that was what led to her arrest. Ms. Cooper Jones' false representation.
Yeah, but again, it's just being said, Jones didn't arrest her.
Well, so now I'm talking about Auberg. And Ms. Auberg's arrest was due to the arrest warrant issued by...
It's due to negligence. At the very least, there's a lot of negligence going on here.
Well, it's not negligence. When he writes a report, when Cooper Jones writes an affidavit of probable cause and criminal complaint that misrepresents the ownership, and he knows that he's misrepresenting the ownership, he knows at that point that the vehicle's titled to Auberg, but then he knowingly disregards that and says that it's owned by the
local. I totally agree with you. I just don't know what to do with it within the confines of 1983. I don't know because someone else made the arrest, and it'd make a great law school question. I don't know what to do with it.
Isn't there an underlying qualified immunity issue running throughout this? And that, as I read these cases, the law is pretty clear in the circuit with respect to self-help. I mean, police assisting a repossession during the actual investigation, during the repossession, but not necessarily following the repossession.
It's the same at all the time.
So the same standard applies?
Well, there's been no notice and opportunity to be heard for the vehicle owner, for any collateral owner. So at that point when Ms. Auberg resists the repossession and takes her car away without a breach of the peace, it's then back in her possession. And in this instance, the police take the car away from her and give it to the creditor and arrest her.
Well, you know, I guess Goldstein is the case. We have said that when a creditor repossesses and doesn't involve a breach of the peace, that's perfectly appropriate if the car is collateral for the loan that gave rise to the lien. So that's what AEL did here. And so when you talk about due process in the context of the repossession, that's what gives me pause, because you're arguing for a pre-deprivation hearing of some sort. But it's clear that we have a creditor exercising some right to repossess collateral of a loan. That pre-deprivation hearing is not part of what you're calling due process. It's something else. Your car, the time is up. Before we hear from your opponents, let me ask you this, because we have counsel here for the township appellants. I don't see anything here that gives rise to any kind of Monell liability against the township. I'm not even sure that you're really pressing the point in your brief. And maybe you can help me. Am I missing something here?
Hold on, go ahead. Detective Palo and Trooper Carrick and Police Officer Kearney were not trained to know that they should not press charges against someone for a self-help repossession.
Okay, thank you. And you did reserve some time. Mr., I'm going to mess this up. I apologize.
Dominicus, Your Honor.
Okay.
Yes. Very good. Good morning, Your Honors.
Good morning.
Good morning, Counsel. The probable cause issue from the Ridley Township officer's perspective is a simple one. Officer Kearney, and actually nobody mentions this, but it's in Officer Kearney's report, and it's in the affidavit of probable cause. Officer Kearney is driving down McDade Boulevard when he sees this vehicle with a blue tarp.
No, I don't think that's a problem. I just don't see that as being a problem. I'm sure that Mr. Sovin would disagree with me, but he clearly had, and I mentioned it to him in my questioning, he clearly had probable cause to stop Edwards.
Absolutely.
And to arrest Edwards, based upon the NCIC information.
Yes.
Okay, I don't see any problem with that.
Yeah, and the false imprisonment is treated the same as the false arrest. So the probable cause takes care of that on behalf of Officer Kearney and Palo. Counsel has referenced in his brief that there were inaccuracies in the affidavit of probable cause. What Lieutenant Palo did was take Officer Kearney's report and basically used after the affidavit of probable cause. At the time Officer Kearney wrote that report, there was nothing inaccurate in there. That's what they believed was the truth. There was nothing in terms of ownership of the vehicle or any of that. So there's no material omissions, no misrepresentations, nothing certainly that
was. Well, it's peculiar to me, not me, but clearly we've got a problem here because the officers, and specifically, I guess, Falcone, was informed what constitutes ownership of a vehicle in Pennsylvania law. Despite that, he ends up putting in information in the affidavit of probable cause that AEL was the owner of the car. Now, that's the problem. I don't know what to make of it, but it's a problem.
Probable cause might insulate you from, you know, false arrest or malicious prosecution, but why is that insulation against the due process? It seems like what Judge McKee is getting at is there's a federal due process claim here.
I don't see how a federal due process claim attaches here to begin with. There was no state action when this vehicle was repossessed.
Client directed that the car be towed with instructions to be delivered to Auto Equity.
Now, if you look at the affidavit of probable cause, they had it towed from the scene by a local tower. Now, the plaintiff wants you to infer that my clients then said to Verone, you can turn this over to the other tow, the repossessor. I don't know how you make that jump. I don't know how that's a reasonable inference, because there's nothing here, nothing in the record that would establish that either Officer Kearney or Lieutenant Palo gave instructions to Verone to turn that vehicle over. And the bottom line, I guess, when you look back at the repossession, there was nothing improper about the repossession. They had every right to repossess the vehicle. So when the vehicle is taken from them under circumstances that would be less than, I guess you'd call it maybe subterfuge. I don't know whether she went there with that intention or not, but she took the vehicle under those circumstances.
Talk about what's in the record, but this was dismissed, and the complaint specifically alleges at paragraph 64 that Palo directed them to turn the vehicle over with instructions to deliver to Auto Equity. So we can't say there's nothing in the record on the in this procedural posture.
There's no factual basis for that.
This is in the it's alleged in the complaint.
I understand that, Your Honor. It's alleged in the complaint, and I can tell you that there's no factual basis.
But don't we have to accept that it's true at this juncture?
This is a dismissal.
So let's assume, obviously, the accuracy of that statement, that that's what occurred. He is given information by the Skipak Barracks that this is the situation. AEL owns the vehicle. Mm-hmm. He puts that in his report. He puts that in his affidavit. Mm-hmm. The plaintiff goes before a judge on an arraignment, and bail set, et cetera. So where is the inaccuracy from where Lieutenant Palo is looking at this? Because that inaccuracy would have to be, as I understand the law, deliberate inaccuracy, not simply a negligent misrepresentation.
Well, couldn't a fact finder conclude deliberate inaccuracy when an officer is informed how you determine ownership of a vehicle, ignores that, and then puts down the creditor as the owner of the car when making out the affidavit? Why wouldn't that be sufficient to get you in trouble?
Because it's already in two law enforcement networks that it's been stolen. He's been given information from a trooper at the barracks as to what happened.
But at that point, he knows who the owner is. He may have been getting information that it was stolen.
But who is the owner of the vehicle? Once it's repossessed, who has the right to it?
It's clear.
Does the
plaintiff say the right? Again, that gets fired.
Does Hallberg have that right?
Isn't he told by an assistant district attorney as to how to determine ownership at this point?
I think that was that came out later in September. That was a discussion between one of the corporals at the state police barracks and an ADA in Montgomery County. See, this happens all on August 17th. The arrest of Edwards, the criminal complaints filed, he's arraigned. These officers from Ridley Township have no further contact with this matter.
Yeah, but Hallberg is also arrested, isn't she?
Excuse me?
Isn't Ahlberg also arrested based upon a search warrant, which is based upon an affidavit that says that the vendor, or the creditor, I'm sorry, is the owner of the vehicle?
Are you talking about Ahlberg?
Correct.
Now, Ridley Township officers had nothing to do with that arrest.
Let me ask you about another claim. There's a conversion claim that got lost in the shuffle. The district court didn't address it. Neither party addressed it. Doesn't that mean we have to send it back down to the district court?
Well, I don't know that it's ever been addressed by plaintiff either. And hasn't he waived that issue on appeal if he hasn't addressed it? That's the only thing I can say. I don't see how, once they have probable cause to make the arrest of Edwards in Ridley Township, that car is going to be impounded. It's going to be taken away.
But then there's affirmative direction to send it back to the tower rather than to send it where Pennsylvania law says to the person who has the title or to hold on to it. Mm-hmm. They're sending it back to the AEI, and that itself could be conversion.
Well, again, we come back to who had the right to the vehicle. That I think is the issue, not who is the technical owner of the vehicle.
So it's bound up with this due process. Like, you got to go through due process before you figure out who gets it. You don't just turn it over to AEI.
But see, the problem with that is the due process, which would have to apply when it was repossessed to begin with. Mm-hmm. There was no state action there. There's no issue there with due process. That's a contract action. Okay, so once that...
Then once they arrest him, they don't send it back to the person who's on the title. They go and send it to AEI.
I don't think the title, though, is dispositive, because if a car is legitimately repossessed and my name is still on that title, does that give me the right to repossess it from the repossessor? I don't believe so. I don't know that there's any law been cited that says that's the case. So Lieutenant Palo said to Verones, give it back to AEL, whoever that repossessor was, I don't think there's any violation there at all. At all. So... I'm sorry, I might red light slip, but the court have any further questions?
I don't. No, I don't.
No, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Sorrell, two preliminaries. First of all, Trooper Jones.
Let us state your name for the record first.
Sorry.
Just put your name for the record first.
My name is Claudia Tesoro, and I represent the state police.
Okay, I'm sorry.
You've conceded in a footnote. The claims against Trooper Jones need to go back for him to answer. And those just, he moved to dismiss only Ahlberg and Edwards state law claims, so the 1983 claims should not have been dismissed. Those have to go back.
I think that yes, basically, I know the footnote you're referring to, and the district court went way too far as Jones is concerned, because Jones did not move to dismiss the key claims.
And it's to your credit that you've set that aside. That's something that the district court ought to deal with. And the conversion point here, no one really seems to be discussing the conversion claim here. I guess that's not against the state defendants, though, is it? That's against
It's kind of hard to tell what's alleged against whom because the complexity of the counts and who's named in which ones. But I do think it's very significant, and this was kind of touched on before. Conversion is a tort. It's a state law matter. There is no discussion one way or another in the appellant's brief about any state law claims and the supposed necessity of keeping them alive. And as far as I'm concerned, the state law claims went by the wayside as a result of that. There's no real need to probe the non-federal claims against whoever is before the court now.
Well, false arrest and imprisonment are
those are federal claims, potential federal claims. I don't question that those have to be sorted out, although not as to Jones at this point.
But what do we do about that? It is troubling what happened here. And because of the messiness of it, use this very apt description of this, it's really hard. It's like nailing, as Judge Becker used to say, it's like nailing jelly to the wall. It's really hard to get a grasp of this.
You and me both, Your Honor. I think the case has been presented in a pretty difficult to follow way. My point in being here now is to explain why the claims against the state police appellees other than Jones, there's no basis for those.
So you admit there is a basis for a claim as to Jones. So maybe you can address whether or not qualified immunity would shield him from that claim.
I didn't hear the last part of what you just said.
Address whether or not qualified immunity would shield him from that claim, because it seems either an intentional act or deliberate indifference, where he has information which he totally ignores that leads to someone's subsequent arrest and the way the affidavit was prepared. Was that Jones? So I confused the players.
Jones filed the initial report, and that's the only thing that got this, that's what got this ball rolling, as I understand it.
Yeah, you're talking about the report going from the repossession yard.
The bare report that Top Notch said that the car was taken.
That's August. We're now into September. Didn't there come a point where Allberg, not Edwards, because I don't think there's any problem with Kearney's action vis-a-vis Edwards, but didn't there come a point where an arrest warrant was issued for Allberg?
There did come such a point, yes.
And that was based upon information which is dead wrong, and the officer who prepared the affidavit which gave rise to the arrest warrant knew that the information that was going into that it was dead wrong.
I don't know. I mean, when you say dead wrong, I'm not sure I'd
but
go
didn't,
that
didn't
far.
The ADA, I think on September 6th, the assistant district attorney told Falcone, I think it was, that ownership is determined based upon the title owner, not the lien holder.
There is something in the documents that says that. Although I would like to offer a way of making sense of that, which is, any one of us in this courtroom may have bought a car and financed it or borrowed money against our car. We still have the title, and there is a lien on the car, which is recorded by PennDOT or whoever, to demonstrate that the ownership of the car is subject to a lien, an interest of another party. And that's what got this entire mess, if you forgive me for using a colloquialism, into the courtroom.
But she was arrested for stealing her car.
But she did not have an absolute right to have the car once the creditor had exercised its right to repossess due to nonpayment.
So the Trooper Jones claims are going to have to be dealt with on remand. But Corporal Falcon, or I don't know if it's Falcon or Falcone, Falcon is the one who consults with the ADA and nevertheless goes ahead. He does the title search, learns Allberg owned the car, but he still recommends charges. So why can't he be liable for false arrest or imprisonment for setting the wheels in motion and submitting this that leads to her being arrested and imprisoned?
I don't think Falcone did as much as you suggest.
He's the one who spoke to the ADA, I think, on September 6th.
He did speak to the ADA, but that kind of goes to my theory about what does or doesn't justify repossession of a car or retaining it or not retaining it or allowing it to be held by a repossessor and so on.
What do we make of the allegations in the complaint that we have to accept as true that he was given that information by an assistant district attorney?
Well, it's a recounting in the documents of what this assistant district attorney said. And I think that what may have been said is probably more complicated than what's written there.
Mr. Searle, I'm looking at Exhibit B in Appendix A-59. It's a report by Corporal Thomas Falcon.
Yes.
He says on September 4th, 2018, ADA Correa related proper ownership will be determined by the title. And then further down on that page, September 6th, Trooper Ristigarpina checked PennDOT. The owner is displayed as Ayanna Allberg, but a lien shows auto equity. And then recommendation, based on the guidance provided by the DA's office review of the title history, I recommend proceeding with charges against Allberg for theft and unauthorized use. So he's recommending charges in the face of the ADA's advice to the contrary. Why doesn't that open up for liability for false arrest and malicious prosecution?
I think that one of the problems is that page that you're reading from is the only thing we have about Falcone.
Why should this survive a motion to dismiss? One page. The jury can do what it wants with that page, but that's enough to get past a motion to dismiss.
But we have to read it in context with the rest of the complaint.
Read in the light most favorable to the non-moving party.
Okay, but the non-moving party does not deny that the car was originally repossessed from her at a point when she apparently, for reasons we don't know, had stopped making her payments. And that brings me full circle to my point about the fact that the repossession occurred because the payments were stopped kicks in the rights of the lien holder.
Not to arrest her, though.
Not to arrest her,
and
no.
And the charger was stealing the car. And that's what happened. They arrested her and charged her with stealing the car.
But she, I think that we are a bit constrained here because it seems to me that the eventual unwinding of all this would show that she...
But that's, again, beyond the face of the complaint.
I know, but she says, and on the face of the complaint and on the face of the documents, that she went to the lot merely to pick up her possessions. And then she jumped on the idea of, hey, that gate is open, and she drove it away. She did not secure any kind of concession or recognition or anything else. She hadn't, the car was in the proper possession of the lien holder when she did that, because she had not paid her payments, and the repossession had occurred, and there was perhaps a conflict of whose interests would trump whose interests that might have eventually resulted in her getting out from under the deal because, as she alleges, it was usurious. But the repossession was proper. There's language, I think maybe one of the court mentioned
that's
it earlier.
I mean, the fact that the repossession, at least the initial repossession, was proper doesn't get us anywhere. That just explains what the car was doing in the lot.
Well, the initial repossession was okay. I don't think we have any
dispute
about that. And once it was in the possession of the recovery lot, there was nothing inherently wrong with that.
Right.
What I think is very questionable, although I can't find another case like this where somebody, quote unquote, is accused of stealing her own car. I don't think it happens much, apparently.
I sure hope it doesn't.
I sure hope so, too. I think that was a very a very unwise decision on her part, frankly. And if all she did was go to the lot by her own account to pick up her belongings, it's very questionable whether she had the right to drive it out, even though the gate
was. Whether she did or not, she ends up getting arrested, as I think the officer admitted, for stealing her own car.
Yes, but she defends herself, or the charges run their course, and eventually she is not convicted of a crime. So,
well, you know, the other matter, and I guess it's beyond our inquiry, but it's very, very troubling that if we look at the underlying loan, 600% is the interest rate. And that would make Tony Soprano blush.
Your Honor, I'm completely on board with that problem. And in fact, I'll just throw out here, our office, in a completely different context, is involved in consumer-related cases against auto equity loans and similar companies because
that's good
they're
to hear.
Being investigated for whether they can be held to Pennsylvania's usury restrictions.
Well, that's
and so
good to
on.
Hear.
That's terrible, but that's really not relevant.
That's
to
not case. Relevant here, but she's actually alleging she wasn't even in default because if you apply the 6% legal rate to it, she's saying her payments were current. But that's not in front of us. It's beyond.
It's not,
it.
And she did sign the contract, and she did incur the debt and so on, so we're really going off the deep end there,
yeah,
but
yeah.
Anyway, except as to Jones, who we agree should have a chance to develop his own defenses, as to the other state police defendants, we ask you to affirm. Thank you.
What about Falcone? It troubles me.
I understand because of all that's been said this morning that it's troubling to you and to the other members of the bench, but one thing that I think is it sort of screams out, for want of a nail, a kingdom was lost. I mean, Falcone did write that one-page report. That's the only thing he did. And he said in there, I recommend that this be pursued.
Right. And that one-page report, maybe the only thing he did. It's like saying, well, he just pulled the sugar. That's all he did, a little tiny sugar.
No, but afterwards, it took a lot more than just that one page to proceed to develop the case and so on and so forth. And if just because he told the colleagues something that at this stage is being questioned, I don't think is enough to make him liable for everything that happened afterwards.
We're not talking about liable. We're just talking about getting beyond 12b-6. We're not here to establish liability. We're just whether or not there's enough to go forward.
Well, okay. And I think that's a helpful point for you to bring up. Even though I don't think that it states a claim, I do think that if it goes any further, he has a lot to explain or not explain, and the consequences of who said what and who did what and who was really responsible for the challenged events will be sorted out.
Okay, Ms. Adjusson, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Sullivan?
Well, one thing I want to point out is that we don't concede that there is a default of this loan. The default is...
No, I understand that. I just mentioned that to Mr. Sorrell. You're not conceding default, but that doesn't help us. That's not really relevant. That's beyond the scope of our inquiry.
Well, it's the unilateral assertion of the creditor, and but for the police to... But hopefully this is within the scope, is that in order for the police to act on it, there has to be notice and opportunity first. They can't inject the state action, even if they believe there was a breach, until there's some notice and opportunity to be heard. That might be one page in the police report that Officer Falcon investigated the situation, but as a result of that one page, he found out that this car was owned by Ms. Auberg, and it, nevertheless, he directed Trooper Jones to have to issue an arrest warrant against her, and then that arrest warrant was misrepresented the ownership of the vehicle, misrepresented the order to repossess the vehicle, saying that it was an order when it's a private request to repossess the vehicle. Those things should open up the door to 1983 liability against Mr. Jones and Mr. Patterson. The Officer Palo or Detective Palo, the inference against him should be when he wrote his affidavit of probable cause, the inference should be that he knew that the vehicle belonged to Auberg because it's in the police report. It's in Jones's police report. And the police look up title information, look up vehicle information all the time. The inference, we assert that he would have looked it up, and that's a reasonable inference. It's also a reasonable inference that the Ridley Township Police, Detective Palo, ordered the car to be given to the creditor and not to the person who was the title owner. And, you know, when they, you know, if there was some notice and opportunity to be heard, the creditor would actually have to prove that there is a security interest. The police don't know that without that, and would have to prove that there's a breach. Under Pennsylvania law, a secured creditor is not the victim of a theft crime as a matter of black letter law.
Okay, I think that helps you. But we understand your argument, though. Any questions?
No.
Okay, thank you very much, Mr.
Okay, thank you very much.
A very interesting case. I wish it were a little more lucid, but it's a very interesting case. Thank you very much. We'll take the matter under advisement.